It's my pleasure to introduce Joe Grand. He is an electrical engineer at Grand Idea Studios and a former Loft Heavy Industries member. And he has recently authored a book entitled Hardware Hacking, Have Fun While Voiding Your Warranty. It's a Singer's book. So without any further ado, Joe.
All right, thanks. Can you guys hear me with this? I'm not used to wired microphones. I'm going to use this one. There, that's better. Cool, thanks, Froggy. Thanks, everyone, for showing up so early. I know it's probably hard for a lot of people. I am Joe Grand. Some of you guys might know me as Kingpin from The Loft back in the day. I am originally from Boston, also a co-founder of a security consulting company called At Stake, which I'm no longer involved in. I'm in San Diego now. I run my own company called Grand Idea Studio. I do product development, security product analysis. People pay me to break things. People pay me to design things. I give talks. I write books and do anything that's fun that makes money. So that's me. You guys are here for the Advanced Hardware Hacking Techniques talk, which sort of seems backwards because later in the day, Scott Fulham, who's up here, has a talk on introduction to hardware hacking. So I have to get on a plane in a little while, so that's why this is going first. But if you're interested in other hardware hacking stuff, definitely go to Scott's talk as well. Let's see. Before we start, one question is, how many people here are actively involved in hardware hacking or kind of messing around with products and things like that? About half. And I assume the other people are hopefully just interested in that or waiting for the next talk. Okay. Cool. Good. So this is going to be fun. And definitely, there's a lot of people in here, and I don't really know how it works with DEF CON, but if you have questions, raise your hand while I'm talking, because it's better than me just standing up here and rambling for a while, and it'll make it a little more interactive as well. So I'm going to mention a few little incentive pieces to stay until the end. This is one of my books from Singer's Publishing, Hardware Hacking, that Froggy mentioned. I have one copy here I'm giving away. We have a book signing afterwards for the talk or for the book, and then at 12:30, you can buy some balls and try to dunk me in the pool, I guess. So do that too. I also have a book from O'Reilly called Security Warrior, written by, where is he? Seth Fogey, somewhere way over there. So I have some of these to give away, and I have some shirts to give away. So if you're good and you stay through the talk, then maybe you'll get those. All right, so let's see. Here we are. Basically, what you see is what you get. This talk is pretty straightforward. We're going to just discuss a little bit about what hardware hacking is, at least for me personally, why I do it, and then get into some attacks. More of a higher level. I'm kind of assuming that you guys know a little bit about electronics or soldering and things like that. If not, then Scott's talk will be perfect for you. So hardware hacking, I might be preaching to the choir here, but basically hardware hacking is doing something with a piece of technology or with a product that's never been done before. It's just like any other sort of hacking. At least for most people, in the natural sense of the word, you're not harming anybody in the process. You're doing something that's cool and that's creative and that, you know, requires some thinking. And it's also a personal thing. You know, a lot of hardware hacking, post-personalization, I put here customization, hot rodding for geeks is kind of the word. You know, it's making something yours by modifying it or making it look cool. Or when someone's like, oh, shit, that's an awesome, you know, hack, man, what'd you do? You know, then it's kind of cool. Adding functionality to a product. Adding hard drives to your machines, whatever, performance increase. And then obviously you have the protection and security mechanisms, getting things for free that cost money. I don't really talk about them here, but obviously the stuff we talk about could be used in that way. If you want to do that, go ahead. Hardware hacking has been around for a long time. I mean, you have like Ben Franklin, Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, guys that have been doing it for a while. It wasn't called hardware hacking back then. You know, they're inventing technologies that people take for granted now. So it's pretty amazing. And it seems to be that hardware hacking is definitely becoming more of like a mainstream thing, and people are accepting it because it is kind of cool. And, you know, we've been able to write books on it, and it's been pretty well received. So kind of cool. So why hardware hacking? For me, again, it's curiosity. I've always liked to see how things work. You know, that's like the hacker mindset, I guess. No one told me to go do that. It's just something that I've always wanted to do. Improvement, innovation, you know, a lot of commercial products out there are usually limited in some way, intentionally a lot of times. So being able to make those products better or cooler or to do something better that I want, it's worth doing. And then also consumer protection. A lot of times, especially in the computer security industry, you see all the glossy marketing materials. They're like, yeah, we're the most secure hardware out there. We're the most secure product. Trust us, it's secure. And this is coming from either booth babes or from other marketing guys that have no idea what the product is about anyway. They're just selling something. So I don't trust the brochures, and the question here is, do you? And that, you know, that's another reason for hardware hacking. It's verifying what's out there. If someone says something is secure, check it out. Prove them wrong, and chances are it will be insecure. So some myths related to hardware security and secure hardware design and products that incorporate some sort of security is that most of the products rely on misconceptions to remain secure. And that's basically because of marketing people not understanding stuff. But the myths are basically that hardware hacking is hard. It's difficult. A lot of people can't do it. They have to be uber smart and know a lot of things. And that's totally untrue because obviously it's, you know, hardware hacking is tinkering with electronics. It's doing, it's breaking things and seeing what happens and trying again and putting in new components and seeing what happens. It's not hard. It's just that, you know, it's what the man wants you to think. And it's also, you know, it might be hard to people that don't have the mindset like we do. Consumers lack the competency or courage to void their warranty. That's most of mainstream America, even though, you know, other than the people that buy the book, they buy a product, they think, whatever they buy is what they get, they don't want to mess with it anymore, and they just trust that whoever designed it, it was doing the right thing. And for the most part, that's probably not a good way to look at things, because most products that are out there suck in one way or another. So another myth is that hardware is safe because of these things, and it's not, and there's a lot of security problems, there's a lot of things you can do with hardware, obviously, or we wouldn't be giving talks like this, that you could do. So it's pretty cool. One example like that I kind of have for one security-related product is really understanding what the security is within a product. There's something I saw in one of the engineering trade rags a little while ago that was this desencrypted RF module. So you have point-to-point encrypted communications and stuff, which sounded really rad, and it kind of made sense. So the encryption between the two points was probably fine. I mean, the data was probably protected. But then on both ends, you had these devices that had their 56-bit, I guess it was 56-bit key, but that doesn't even matter, that were stored in serial double EEPROM devices, which we'll get into a little bit. But they're basically totally insecure memory devices that you can just communicate with two or three wires and read the information out of. So although the data was encrypted, you could just go to one of those products, grab the key right out of it, and then you'd be able to decrypt the transmissions there. So even if people try to design security into products, they might not get it right. So we have a few other high-level slides here. There's a few ways to gain access to a product if you do want to do hardware hacking or you do want to break a product. Depending on your goals, for the most part, what we'll do is purchase the product, so buy it with cash if you don't want to be detected. A lot of people will buy a few of one product and use a few as like sacrificial lambs to try to open them up. If they break something, it's okay. If they find a security mechanism that's used in place, they can try to break that, and then they'll have one good one that they can use to actually, you know, get through the attack. Depending on your purpose, evaluation, a lot of network equipment's pretty expensive, test equipment's expensive, so if you want to rent something, you can do that and try to hack it, and that's something we did a few years ago at AtStake with a crypto accelerator that I think was like $10,000. So we rented it for $1,000 for a month. We were careful when we opened it up not to, you know, mess with it too much. Broke the product, put it back together, and returned it, and it was fine. So, so that was cool. Another way, obviously, active products. So think of like network equipment, routers, things that are in active operation all the time. You might not be able to really do specific hardware hacking at that point, but that is another way to gain access to a product. And then remote access, when you don't have physical access at all. Actually, the active stuff, too, would be like authentication tokens, smart cards, cell phones, things that people are actively using that they might leave at the table and you want to do a hack on it or grab info off it or whatever. Remote access would also be network equipment where you don't have physical access. You're doing stuff over the network, whether it's administration or misconfiguration of administration consoles and things like that. Not quite hardware hacking, but hacking it nonetheless. And then one other slide about this stuff is like there's usually four different high-level things that people are trying to do when they're hacking hardware. Interception or eavesdropping is one, and that's gaining access to information without opening the product. That would be maybe using an external interface, like a hot sync port on a Palm device or some test points that are accessible, or maybe even just monitoring some of the RF transmissions from the device to gain information from. We'll get into that. Interruption, fault generation, preventing the product from functioning normally. It's kind of self-explanatory. modification, something that we all know and love, is usually invasive, opening the product, changing circuitry, changing things to make it do something better. And then fabrication is creating counterfeit assets, so whether that's trying to clone a token by creating counterfeit data or whatever. Sorry, I'm kind of losing my voice. This past 3 days have been a little bit crazy. Enclosure mechanical attacks, we're going to go through two sections here. We have the enclosure, which is all the physical stuff, and then circuitry level, which is the circuit board stuff, obviously. So we're going to go through four different sections here. So the first goal when you're doing hardware hacking is to get access to the circuitry for the most part. For most products, it's as easy as just loosening screws, prying open the device, something pretty easy. You don't need a lot of tools to do it. There's two examples that are up here. The first one is of the iPod, which is one of the chapters in my book. We were replacing the battery and hard drive and stuff, and all it took was either a screwdriver or like a plastic wedge that you could just wedge along the side. There was no screws or anything. So it was cool because Apple was charging, like, I think it was $29 or $99 or something to replace the battery when all you had to do is go buy a $10 battery, open up the thing, and do it yourself. But, of course, they didn't tell you that. So the other thing down here, the bottom one, is a USB authentication token that I'd looked at a few years ago that was supposed to be the secure device, and authentication tokens would basically allow you to say you are who you say you are, and basically like a two-factor authentication thing is you have a password and you have this piece of hardware and you would get access to your network or to your computer. But it turns out that you could just crack these things right open with an X-Acto knife, take the hardware out. We probably have an example in the presentation about what we did, but we ended up cloning the device by just reading the serial EEPROM right out of it. So all we needed there was an X-Acto knife to cut open some glue. When we were done with the hack, we put the circuit board back in, glued the case together, and no one would even know. And we did that on somebody's actual token, and they had no idea because with standard use of like a USB token, it was all kind of roughed up. The housing was scratched up anyway, so if we had messed up, no one's going to know. So a little bit more about opening housings. If glue is used to seal the housing and you can't just get it open with an X-Acto knife, try using a heat gun to soften the glue. A lot of times the glue is not a high temperature. At least it will melt at low temperatures, I should say. Some designers, though, do use a higher temperature glue, which will melt after the plastic of the case does. So then obviously it's gonna be obvious that you've tampered with the device. In some cases that might not matter unless you have to give the product back. Some devices also are sonically welded, ultrasonically welded, or they're like a one-piece design. So you can't really open the device easily without physically destroying it. And you can see the picture down here is of another authentication token that Dark Tangent sent me a few days before this presentation was put together. And I wanted to see how hard it would be to actually open a sealed housing. It's obvious now that I've opened it, but at least I had access to the circuit board. I could pull it right out and then perform my hardware hacks at that level. So another way, a lot of places, Nintendo, Sega, some of the other game systems and vendors use security bits, which are just specialized screw heads. Some of them might use one-way screws, which you can tighten, but you can't loosen. At least they're not supposed to. Think of like all of the screws you see in the bathroom stalls. You know, you can tighten them, and you know, while you're sitting on the can, you're probably thinking of a way to loosen them. So now you can actually try it. There's a website here that's pretty cool to help you figure out what the bit's called that you're trying to access. And then there's a picture, like I picked up this set at the MIT flea market back in Boston a few years ago for like $10. And you can find them at electronic stores all over the place. So all sorts of different security heads that are not standard screwdriver heads. They're called security bits, but they're obviously not if you can buy them in the store. So external interfaces is another thing that you can access from the outside without needing to physically open the device. And it's usually a product's lifeline to the outside world, whether you have like a hot sink port on a Palm device or you have USB. Anything that the product communicates with a computer or with a person through is an external interface. A lot of times there's interfaces that the user might not know or care about that are used for like manufacturing, testing, field programmability, and we'll get into some examples of that, that could be used for hardware-based attacks.
What's JTAG?
JTAG is something we're going to actually get into on the next slide. It's a serial protocol used for board-level and chip-level testing. So we'll get into that, and that turns out to be a major, major problem and something that you guys should all look at if you're hacking stuff. So wireless interfaces, are also obviously external interfaces. We don't touch on them here because there's tons of talks on that and tons of people doing work on it. But Bluetooth, any sort of Wi-Fi, 802.11, those obviously have weaknesses there that you might be able to take advantage of to then gain access to the hardware. So any interface that is accessible to the outside world, you can use as an attacker, just like a manufacturer could use as well. So one thing I have to say about this is look for any hidden interfaces, obfuscated interfaces. As you know, security through obscurity doesn't work, and if a vendor is just trying to hide their manufacturing interface with a sticker, chances are you're going to find it. Two examples are the Nokia phone, which I think is on your left, is just a standard Nokia like 3360 cheapo phone. Behind the battery cover, there's 5 test points right there. Chances are those are for programming, probably for the ESN, probably for MIN, I assume, other cellular-specific information, maybe RF information. I have no idea. But that's obviously a big red flag, you know, a big kick-me flag to, you know, if I was hacking this thing, that's the first thing I'd look. I'd start probing pins, and, you know, we'll get into some examples of how to do that. And then the other one is a particular time-based authentication token some of you might be familiar with. And there's 5 test points that are hidden on the back right under a sticker. It turns out those are for programming also. But I'll leave it as an exercise to you guys to figure out what they actually do. So some things here. If you do find an external interface, what can you do? Use a multimeter, oscilloscope to probe the pins, pull them high and low, see how other parts of the circuitry respond, see how other pins in the bunch respond, because chances are if it's an external test interface, like with the Nokia phone, there was 5 pins, so you probably have a ground and maybe a data in, data out. So you can kind of probe those and see what happens, hook it up to an oscilloscope, see if you get any response back. That works surprisingly well. And with a small amount of pins, you only have a finite amount of possibilities there. So don't be afraid to mess around a little bit. And chances are you're not going to destroy something in the process. If you are, then the product was designed really badly. What you can also do is use like a hardware software-based protocol analyzer. I have examples here for USB and RS-232, but obviously you have, you know, if it's a network-based device, you sniff the network. If it's wireless, all that stuff. For USB, Snoopy Pro is a really awesome tool. It's free. It's up on SourceForge. There is a link to that in the back, I'm pretty sure. And then for RS-232 and parallel port stuff, you have Portmon by SysInternals. So I use a lot of the RS-232 stuff for some of my old POM research when I found out that POM was sending the system password, the user password, over the wire during a hot sync in this encoded form. So just sniff the traffic, figure out, kind of correlate between my real ASCII password, which I knew in this case, compared it to what this encoded thing that was being sent over the wire, and figured out that it was an XOR against a constant block. And then at that point, I knew I could sniff anybody's hot sync transaction, figure out their password. So it's pretty cool to do that. Another thing you can do if you have access to tools that allow you to do this is send intentionally bad packets, malformed packets to cause a fault in the device, and maybe it will throw up some information. It will fail in some way that will give you something useful. Because a lot of times those handling routines aren't handled properly in the hardware, in the firmware. Backdoors. This is one of my favorite slides. A lot of products have debug interfaces, test interfaces that are usually undocumented, and it's for manufacturing purposes, and the vendor doesn't really care that they're accessible to the user because they figure the user doesn't care that they're there. However, for most of us, we do care that they're there. Diagnostic serial ports usually provides some sort of information about the system, like the net structure crypto accelerator I was talking about earlier. There's a link to our work there. Developers' backdoors. Palm OS has another weakness, which is this debug mode that's used for programming. You can enter that debug mode even if the device is locked, gain access to all of the data structures, all of the memory, load files, erase files, do whatever you want at that point. So it's a huge weakness, but it's also, in this case, it's also good for like forensic analysis and real computer security stuff, depending on what you're doing. Also, Sega Dreamcast has another developer's backdoor that allows you to boot regular CD-ROMs. So JTAG, somebody had asked what JTAG is. Basically, it's a really useful serial interface for the industry and for engineers and for manufacturers. However, it's basically the Achilles heel and a huge security problem and something that is probably the first thing that hackers look at when they're looking at a product, trying to break it. It's an industry standard thing. It's fully documented. As I mentioned before, it's used for system level testing and checking dies, checking chips, making sure they're soldered onto the board properly and interconnect work and everything. And it provides a direct interface to the hardware. Most processors have a JTAG module embedded in them. So it ends up being, you'll see on the next slide how many pins. You just connect to that with like a handful of parts through a parallel port, and you can start talking to the processor through the JTAG module, twiddle the pins on all of its pins, and then talk to like flash memory if that's hooked up, or RAM, or whatever you need to do. There is an example of some guys over in the Netherlands, XDA developers looking at a Pocket PC-based device using the JTAG interface. It wasn't accessible to them, but they removed the processor, found out which pins were JTAG, used another device, hooked up pins to the JTAG interface, reprogrammed flash, did all sorts of fun stuff with that, so check out that site. A little bit more on JTAG. It is 5 connections. 4 of them are required. 1 of them is optional. Data in, data out, self-explanatory stuff. There's tons of information on it. There's some links here. So chances are the Nokia phone that you saw is probably a JTAG interface of some sort, and it's worth checking out, worth giving a try. So some other information on JTAG. The one problem for developers is that removing JTAG functionality is pretty much impossible unless you use a device that doesn't support JTAG. If a vendor just cuts traces on the board to try to remove the JTAG functionality or hide it in some way, that's just obfuscation, and all it will take is one attacker to go and find out which traces were cut, resolder those traces, and enable the JTAG port again. So unless you're physically destroying the die, the die section that has the JTAG module, or you're not using JTAG at all, it's going to be a backdoor for products. And also, the more dense products get and the more functionality they have, the higher chance that there will be a JTAG module there. All right, so the next section is on anti-tamper mechanisms, and these are usually physical things that try to prevent somebody from getting access to the circuitry or to particular areas of the circuit board. They're usually used in layers, meaning there's not just one thing like a protective sticker over a screw hole, but it's usually the protective sticker along with some glue, along with some epoxy over a part, along with whatever. So as you'll see, there's a bunch of different things. The thing with anti-tamper mechanisms is they're usually bypassed with the knowledge of method, at least the current features that are out there. So if we can understand what the mechanisms are trying to protect, we can probably get around that. And that's why I mentioned the sacrificial lambs again. We buy 2 products, use one to figure out how it works, and then use the other one to break. So there's 4 different categories of anti-tamper mechanisms. Tamper resistance is the first one, which basically are used to make tampering with the product more difficult. Epoxy around components, one-way screws, I mentioned those. Sealed housings, I mentioned those. Tamper evidence is basically something that will leave visible evidence. So, you know, using a high-temperature glue, and then if you're using your heat gun and you melt the plastic, that's obviously a tamper evidence. But there's actual seals, special finishes on enclosures that scratch easily, that scrape easily. Something that's cool is bleeding paint, which is basically one color of paint with small unpunctured bubbles of a contrasting color. And when you scratch the enclosure, this other contrasting color breaks out of the bubbles, and then you have splotch marks all over the product. So that's something that people try to do. Tamper evident features obviously are only useful if there's a process in place to check that. So if you're working in your garage or in your house trying to break a product and you cut the void, you know, if you open this screw hole, your warranty's void sticker, it doesn't matter. Who cares? But if you're trying to put the product back into someone's purse or something when you're done, you might have a little bit more of a problem. Tamper detection is the third of the 4. Which basically allows the hardware itself to know that a tampering action has taken place, that somebody's tried to open the device, for example, or probe a certain component using switches, sensors, maybe circuitry. There's a lot of different detection features there. The 4th one is tamper response. So that's after the hardware detects that there's a tampering something going on, that somebody's doing something they shouldn't be doing. It will respond in some way. A lot of time that's zeroizing memory, meaning just erasing critical memory, say where crypto keys are or where specific firmware is. Or it might just shut down the device, disable the device. Some devices I put destroy device. Another talk I give, there's an example of one tampered response feature is using a small shape charge to basically destroy the device, explode the device. I'm sure the government or military or Microsoft or something uses that. So if you see guys walking around with like 3 fingers and they, you know, they're hardware hackers. and there's a paper here that basically provides all sorts of attacks and countermeasures around getting around some anti-tamper mechanisms here. And I think we have some examples, too, moving forward, and we do. Conformal coating, epoxy encapsulation is one form of tamper resistance, makes things harder to access components and circuitry. Encapsulation is usually epoxy or urethane, a two-part epoxy glue, basically, covering over circuitry. I don't have a laser pointer, but you can see in the way left, I guess, is that for you? The chip on board, which is basically that black blob. That's a silicon die that's wired directly to the board. And then there's epoxy right over it. So if you want to get access to the chip or to the die at that point, you have to remove that epoxy. This picture is actually something I took a while ago. If someone can identify it, I'd be really surprised. But it's an old Radio Shack tone dialer, for those who remember those. The picture on the top is another USB hardware token that I had looked at. There's epoxy on one side. There's another picture later on, and you see why sometimes using epoxy is totally useless. So they're using it to protect their processor. And then the bottom one is one of the recent devices, another one that Jeff sent me, or that Dark Tangent sent me, is a USB device that was totally encapsulated in epoxy. So it was a pain in the ass to open. But even so, I just heated it up and used an X-Acto knife like you saw in the other picture, opened the device, and scratched off a bunch of the epoxy, and then gained access to the processor, which is a 24-pin SoIC. And it turns out it's a Cypress general-purpose device that has USB support on board. So epoxy is usually... it's used a lot, but the good news is that they're not designed for security, meaning they can be removed. There's one chemical stripper that's really cool that smells pretty good, too. It's the 8310. Put that on, let it sit for a while, start scratching it off with a screwdriver or with an X-Acto knife or a window paint stripper. This stuff usually comes right off. Also, what you can do is I don't remember how we figured this out, but using a Dremel tool with like a wooden skewer as a drill bit helps remove epoxy a lot better than like a metal bit. It doesn't damage the components underneath. And the good thing is when you get down to the component level, if you had metal, you're going to short stuff out and you're going to drill right over stuff. With the wooden bit, it doesn't remove the parts. It just removes the epoxy. Sometimes it might remove the solder mask, the green stuff on the board or whatever color. It's usually green. But that's not really a big deal if you just need access to the components. So here's another picture. When all else fails, you can't get through the epoxy. Use an X-ray machine, figure out what's going on there. This is an excellent picture. A guy a few years ago named Clay Cowgill. This is an add-on board for Ms. Pac-Man or Super Pac-Man or something from way back in the day, and Bally was pretty serious about protecting their IP. It basically allowed arcade operators to plug this thing in, remove the old ROMs, plug this thing in, and they'll have a new game with all of the old hardware. So this guy, Clay, spent hours trying to drill through this thing and microwave it and cut it and slice it and dice it. And he just couldn't get through it. So he brought it over to his veterinarian's office and had it x-rayed. And looking at the x-ray gave him enough information to realize that all they were doing, there was another Z80 processor in there with some other just logic chips. And it turns out that all Midway was doing was mixing around some of the address and data lines to confuse somebody. So he figured out that out just by looking at it, figured out which logic parts those were based on just how they were connected. If you look closely, you can actually see trace paths on there. And then he reverse engineered that, and now we have that game to play on emulators. So that's a perfect example of hardware hacking. So getting down into some of the electrical attacks, this is more of my style. I like getting to circuitry level and playing with components and seeing how things work, and there's a bunch of different stuff you can do at this point. I'm going to start with surface mount devices because those are typically what you see nowadays. For some of us older guys, we're used to seeing dip components, through-hole components that are soldered onto the board with huge pins that are ridiculously easy to probe and desolder and do all this stuff with. But nowadays, the technology is getting to a point where it's hard for hobbyists and it's hard for attackers or whoever to work with these devices unless you have specialized equipment, for the most part, as you'll see. So fine pitch packages, BGA devices that have the pins as balls underneath the device so you can't just probe it, little square packages. But don't get discouraged when you see stuff like that, because chances are you'll still be able to access other parts that you need. The good thing is that human hands have more resolution than your eye. So if you are working with surface mount parts, fine pitch parts, get a really nice microscope and you'll be amazed that you can solder these little things. And if you've ever been to like a product manufacturing plant, you see all these tiny little ladies set up across a desk with huge microscopes, and they're doing this amazing soldering. And I'd always just been blown away, and I thought they had like special training and stuff to do this. They had some like ninja skill, but it was the microscope all along. So pick one up at like a flea market or swap meet or whatever, and you can deal with a lot of those fine pitch parts that you wouldn't normally be able to. Circuit Seller, one of the July issue that was last month's issue, has something on building your own surface mount heat oven, basically, little reflow oven. So you can solder your own devices and heat up the solder enough to remove devices and things in your own house with a cool little computer-controlled oven. Also, check out the August issue, which has an article I wrote.
You can actually use a toaster oven for that too, if you crank it up all the way.
Yeah, you can use a toaster oven, as Scott says, if you crank it up all the way. The problem there is that if you want to actually solder surface mount parts onto the board, the solder paste and kind of has a special reflow process that you want to use to make sure the things are actually soldered to the board properly. So you need to heat up really fast and then stay for like 2 minutes at a certain temperature, drop down a little bit, because you don't want to cool too fast and you don't want to heat too slow and all these things. But yeah, you can also just use an oven. And you can be your own computer and just open the door to change the temperature. So a little bit more on some surface mount devices. Here's an example using something called the ChipQuick removal system. It's a guy that I actually met back in Boston, and he's at a lot of these shows just selling this type of solder, basically, that's a low melting point solder. So what you do, and there's an example here. It goes from left to right. Or something from the, I don't know. You can figure it out. Basically, you attach this low melting point alloy to the board, which basically mixes with the solder that's on there, and then it melts at such a low temperature that it remains melted for long enough where you can heat all of the pins at once, slide the thing right off the board, and then use some alcohol, clean the pads right off, and then you can start hacking stuff that way. This is an example of one of my other products, so check out the website. Another plug. So probing boards is something else you want to do, obviously, at a board level. Look for test points. Look for things that might be out of the ordinary, interesting-looking traces, bus lines that might be coming between the processor and flash memory, stuff like that. The surface mount leads and points are usually too small to manually probe, and so for the most part, if there's something that's useful for the manufacturer to test, they'll put a test point. They'll put a larger pad there that you can start probing. Chances are, if a manufacturer puts something useful for them on the board, it's going to be useful for you on the board as well. There are tons of ways to access boards and to probe boards. You can either solder a wire onto a specific area using the microscope, again, if it's a fine pitch part. Use something called an SMD micro grabber, surface mount micro grabber, $5 to $50, depending on where you go, flea markets, which will basically be a little clip that will allow you to clip right onto a specific pin, and then that could connect out to a multimeter or to your oscilloscope or something like that. Or you can use a probe adapter, which are more expensive. There's a bunch of companies that do it that will either change the footprint type into something more accessible. So if it's a BGA device, you can put a BGA adapter on instead and then connect that up to a logic analyzer. All sorts of different interconnection things that you can do to gain access to the parts. Some of them are actually clip-on. So you clip on to a fine pitch part, and it breaks it out to all of these pins that you can then start probing. Or you can build your own. And this is something that's really cool that Bunny Huang did, who wrote the Hacking the Xbox book. He's coming here tonight, as far as I know. An amazing hack that he did as part of his book was to break Microsoft's little security scheme, at least one of them, was to monitor some of the address and data lines going on their hyper-transport bus, which is a high-speed interconnection system. And it turns out that he built this little board, that little tap board there, that basically was just a high-speed logic part that then connected off to another FPGA of his and off to a logic analyzer that let him analyze the data going over that bus, and he figured out a way to load unauthorized code onto the Xbox, which was pretty awesome. And those pins are really fine pitch. So he built this board and then just scraped off some of the solder mask on the board, attached his tap board to it, epoxied it down, and then soldered those connections with the microscope, and then he could monitor it. So really cool stuff. Memory and programmable logic is another area you're going to want to hit. Most memory is totally insecure. Memory devices weren't designed with security in mind, meaning that You don't need to worry about security. You remove the device, you read it, you get the contents out, you analyze it at that point. I mentioned serial double EEPROMs already. They're used in tons of devices. They could usually be read in circuit, so you don't even need to remove the device. You can just clip on using a dip clip or whatever, connect that into your device programmer and read it, or connect up to your little homebrew programmer that hooks up to your parallel port. The problem with memory for designers is it's hard to securely and totally erase data from non-volatile memory, from RAM, if a product is storing crypto keys in memory, for example, or storing something useful in memory, and then the vendor goes to erase it, the device goes to erase it, some of that data is still there. So there is a reference to that, and some work's been done that basically long after the power's been removed or long after those gates have been changed, you can still find slight voltage differences to allow you to recreate data that's already been there. It's kind of like a burn-in of a monitor. So you can take advantage of that and get all sorts of goodies. FPGAs are used a lot. SRAM-based devices are basically used everywhere an FPGA is used at this point, and they're totally open to attack. And the problem is that FPGAs need to load their configuration data for what they're supposed to do from an external device. You can monitor that bit stream, figure out what it's doing, or a lot of the devices use a serial double EEPROM to store the information, so you just read the double EEPROM. Figure out what they're doing, even put it in your own FPGA and start working on it that way. There are new devices that are out there that are flash-based, I guess, FPGAs that have all of the configuration data stored internally. You can't do this sort of attack, and you also can't really do die-level attacks, which we talk about, because of their structure. Those are actually designed for security. If you're working with a PLD, a kind of low-budget programmable logic device, try an IO scan attack, which is basically cycling through all the different combinations of inputs and outputs on the pins, probing things, and see how it reacts in that case. Some devices do have security fuses or boot block protection, which are typically used to like protect a specific area of memory, whether it's for a certain bootloader or some write once area. Most people use them. Some people don't, so it's something that if you're trying to read a device and it doesn't let you, the security bit might be set. There are ways to bypass that, and we'll look at that. There's one example here, which is an old PIC device, a microchip general-purpose processor, that has a security bit that would prevent a user from reading the data programmed into the device once it was programmed. But it turns out that increasing the power fluctuation, I think on either the programming line or one of the write-enable lines, will erase the security bit. So you just fluctuate the power, you can erase the bit, and then you can read the device and pull all the stuff right out of it. So that was kind of cool. And someone says it was in the original DirecTV hack, which is pretty cool too. So probably if you search for DirecTV in PIC 16C84, you'll probably find a lot of information on that. All right, this is another really cool section. Chip decapping and die analysis is kind of an advanced technique that a lot of people talk about, or at least more people are talking about, but it still seems that a lot of people don't really have the balls to do anything with it. Hopefully some of you guys will, because it's pretty sweet. Basically what it is analyzing the physical IC dies of devices, and you see an example of one here, which is just an EEPROM device that has the die wire bonded there. So basically, with access to the IC die, you can get anything you need. Flash, ROM, if it's FPGAs, you can pull out keys, you can destroy gates, or you can add bits back in. So if someone blows a security fuse on a device, if you have access to the die with special tools, you re-enable the security bit, and then you can read the device as normal. All sorts of cool stuff here, and we'll get into some of that. So the good thing is that IC designers make mistakes, so they need tools to figure out what's going on, failure analysis, chip repair, inspection, anything that they can use, we can use too. What tools? Chip decappers. We'll get into each of these. Scanning electron microscopes, voltage contrast microscopy, and FIB, focused ion beam work. So really cool stuff. And let's see. The equipment's available for most of these tools on the used and surplus market. For most people, they're still a little bit expensive. But if you get lucky and you work in a place that might have some of this equipment, which if you're in any sort of product development environment, you probably do, you just might not know it. And if you're in a university, you probably have access to that. If you talk to the right people, the right professors, they'll let you use the stuff on weekends or whatever. Though some of the tools, like the decapper, uses fuming nitric acid, and you probably want to do that with somebody who knows what they're doing. Another thing is there are reverse engineering services available, which are way too expensive for any useful hardware hacking, that will basically reverse engineer at a chip level what the device is doing, what sort of process it was designed with, maybe even break it down to a schematic level of gates. And there's some links there if you want to pay the money. So IC decapsulation, this is what I just mentioned, it's basically removing the plastic top or removing the top from an IC and gaining access to the die. Because for the most part, when you look at ICs, at integrated circuits, all of the plastic housing, the die is tiny. And then all of the other shit you see is just a plastic housing around it. That's why with DIP parts from way back in the day, the die was still pretty small, and it was just the plastic and breaking it all out. So you can either remove the housing using chemical or mechanical or both if you want something useful. Mechanical, obviously, you'd slice. Chemical, you'd burn through or etch through. The good thing is that if you're removing the top, you're still keeping the die intact, so you can do your hacks on an active device. Maybe put some epoxy back over it when you're done and throw it back in someone's purse. I mean, who knows? The good thing is you remove the cap and the device still works, which is cool. So then you can change contents of flash, check it out with a microscope, change contents of flash, look again, or whatever. There's some references here. So here are some cool pictures. With a scanning electron microscope, is basically what you're going to use is a ridiculously high-powered microscope to look at dye levels at a submicron level. So you can see there's two pictures down here. One of them, the pink one, you can actually make out certain bits of a ROM, and you can figure out which fuses are set and which fuses are blown, recreate that binary data and put it together and figure out what it is. The one problem is if you do get access to a die, depending on the process, there might be metal or other layers on top of the actual physical die that you'll need to etch through. If you do that, your chip isn't going to work anymore, and that's why you have your sacrificial lamb. Depending on the ROM size, you can visually recreate stuff like the pink picture, for 1,000 bits, but if you have like 10 megs or whatever, 2 megs of flash, it's going to be a pain in the ass. So you can use voltage contrast microscopy instead, which basically detects the variances of voltages and displays it in a way that a human can see them a little easier. It's performed in conjunction with a scanning electron microscope, and there's another picture here that will basically allow you to extract information from a flash ROM device. And flash is most commonly used in most products these days. And I mean, this type of stuff, you'd have to be pretty dedicated to do it, but if you're dedicated, then you make a good hacker. Also, what you can do now, focused ion beams is another thing. You can basically send a stream of ions, and depending on the current of the ion beam, you can either cut the silicon die. See you guys. Add deposit layers to it, or actually image the device. So cutting, you can cut a trace. Deposit, you can write stuff to it, and we have cool pictures. Imaging the device is something pretty awesome, too, which is basically a higher resolution image of the die than what you get from a scanning electron microscope. Pictures here. These levels are ridiculously small, less than probably the width of a human hair. And there's one picture with a circle around it is somebody had cut a trace of a die, so just removing one part of that chip. And then the nano deposition and nano machining, they're cutting into the silicon die and adding stuff. So it's pretty cool. Here's some other awesome pictures. These are basically 3D little artwork that people have drawn onto silicon dies using focused ion beams. So I don't know how good that would actually be for hardware hacking, because for the most part, you'd probably just cut traces or add traces to it. But they're just kind of demonstrating. And there's companies that do that. Another thing here, emissions and side channel attacks. A lot of you are probably familiar with Tempest-based attacks. Wim van Eck from the Netherlands a long time ago, monitoring the emissions from computer monitors, the high voltage spikes, and basically recreating that information on another monitor. Basically, all devices create some sort of electromagnetic interference, some sort of RF interference. A lot of times, that stuff is just noise. Other times, you could actually use it to retrieve information like van Eck did. And probably the government does all the time. And you can use it maybe to retrieve crypto keys or figure out where and when the product is performing certain operations. There's a bunch of papers to that. Some people have actually, for some reason, attached like activity LEDs, activity indicators, directly to the serial lines of modems, of network equipment that would allow you to monitor the radiation from the LED, and you'd be retrieving data that's going across the wire. And there's two papers to that. Some other cool things is some of the devices could also be susceptible to RF. So instead of actually emitting, if you send RF to the device, they might fail. HRF guns, people might be familiar with, high energy RF. If you blast a device with enough RF energy, it might totally fail or it might crash in some way that could be useful. The problem with that is you can't really control that type of thing. So if you do it once, you might not get the same thing the next time. Monitoring the power supply is another technique you can do to gain information. Simple power analysis is one. DPA is another. There's some links there. Basically measuring the power, seeing what's going on at particular instances. Clock and timing. So measuring the clock processor, speeding it up, slowing it down. Say if you're working on a time-based hardware token, for example, you might want to speed up the clock to get more one-time passwords generated so you can figure out how those are being generated. Or you do passive timing attacks where you're measuring computation time because different tasks take different amounts of time. You figure out what's going on. So security through obscurity doesn't work. I'm preaching to the choir here. It provides a false sense of security to people. For us, it only takes one person to figure it out, post it on a website, write a paper about it, give a talk about it, and everybody knows about it. So it might temporarily discourage one person, but it only takes one, again, to discover it. So some weak things to look at that vendors try to do to obfuscate things. They'll encode forms of data like Bally did with their Pac-Man thing. They'll scramble address lines through additional logic. They might write code that is intentionally lousy, intentionally bad to try to confuse you when you're reverse engineering stuff. And they might also have some spurious, meaningless data, stuff that doesn't do anything, kind of like you're spending all your time probing one thing and it's actually not even doing anything. So two more slides, I think, and I'm done. Hardware hacking challenges, some things to look for nowadays with the newer technologies. Chip packaging, I mentioned this. A lot of places are moving towards fine pitch, ultra fine pitch packaging. BGA, chip on board. Some people are actually embedding dies into the board now, chip in board. So you basically have to dig through the board to get access to the die. It's harder to do, but you can still be done. It can still be done. Discrete components are so small now you could inhale them. You wouldn't even know. It's been done. high-speed boards. Things are getting a lot faster than they were a few years ago. Processor memory buses are getting very high. The design of circuit boards are then related to that. They need to be designed a certain way to handle the high speeds. Serial bus speeds are very fast now. So some things you might not be able to just hook up to a logic analyzer. You might need to build a tap board like Bunny did because things are moving so fast. But you can capture that data and analyze it offline. Cost of equipment is still a problem for us. The tools are still, for the average hobbyist, they're still expensive unless you're in school and you do have access to that information. For us, the state of the art's defined by what we can find in the trash and at swap meets. You'd be surprised at what you find in the trash. If you don't look in the trash now, start. Especially at high technology companies. Be careful of jumping in the dumpster, but look through the dumpster and wear shoes. And then pressures from society is something that we have to deal with every day as hackers, every day. And it's been the same for years and is never going to change. Hardware hacking is becoming a mainstream thing. As I mentioned, there's books available and there's lots of talks on it and Tech TV has Yoshi doing stuff. But hacker is still a bad word. And no matter who you tell, people are going to say, ooh, scary hacker. So, we have some pressures and when you try to hardware hack stuff, it's still a problem. Conclusions, basically, I mentioned hardware hacking, mainstream activity, but we still have to fight. We still have to explain to people why we're doing what we're doing and why it's fun. But it does play an important role in testing developers and testing vendors and showing that we're not just going to take what they make and believe what they say. One thing is when you are hacking a product is think as a designer would. Put yourself in their mindset and figure out, if they're trying to do something a certain way, it's probably to make their job easier. So think in that way, and then you can figure out what they're doing and break it. So with the JTAG interface, it's going to help them. It's also going to help you. Nothing's 100% secure ever, no matter what people tell you. Given enough time, you can do just about anything. Possibilities are endless, and have fun while you're doing it. So let's see. In the back, there's a ton of references. I believe the presentation's on the CD. Tons of resources, websites, some tools that you can get going with hardware hacking. And that's it. So I don't even know if we have time for questions, but thanks.